So for the past 2 weeks, we've been discussing the physics of systems in the Ising universality class. Which basically means that the order parameter is a scalar, right? It's a scalar field. And so the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory has symmetry with respect to changing sign of this field, right? So this gives us this is a characteristic of the Ising universality class. So now a natural extension of this would be to consider systems with higher symmetry of the order parameter. So, for example, I can, instead of starting from the Ising model, where the degrees of freedom are spins, which can take only two values, plus or minus one, I can start with the following model. So, again, I imagine a hypercubic lattice in d dimensions. And so the Hamiltonian has the following form, minus one half. Sum over I and j, again, j, I, j. And now instead of, just plus and minus ones on different sides, I have vectors. So S I dot S j, where S are unit vectors, right? So S I dot S I is equal to 1, and S can be vectors with several components, for example, 3. So SIX, SIY, SIZ, right? So the Ising model that we've considered before, I can obtain the Ising model if I add the following term to it. So let's say minus some constant k sum over I S I Z squared, right? So what this term does is it prefers, strongly prefers the spins to be pointing only in the Z direction, right? And then if k is sufficiently large, then this becomes an Ising model, okay? But now I want to remove that. I don't want this term. Okay. So this is called Heisenberg model. And so the difference between this and the Ising model is symmetry, right? So the Ising model has discrete symmetry. Meaning that, the symmetry transformation is basically multiplying all the spins by minus one, right? So sigma I goes to minus sigma I, right? And so in the formal language, this is the symmetry group of the Ising model is Z2. Meaning that, the group of the symmetry transformations of the Ising model contains two elements, right? Unity and minus one, right? So the symmetry group of this model is very different, right? So here, since this Hamiltonian contains a scalar product of the two spins, I can rotate all the spins by an arbitrary angle, right? And this Hamiltonian is going to remain invariant. So this model then has a continuous symmetry. Heisenberg model has a continuous symmetry, meaning the symmetry group consists of a group of all rotations of let's say three component spins by an arbitrary angle, right? And that angle can change continuously. So this is continuous symmetry. So in the case of three component spins, this is all three. So this is a group of all orthogonal 3 by 3 matrices. It's a group of rotations of three component spins. Okay. And it turns out that, you know, this the fact that you know, so the Ising model has discrete symmetry while Heisenberg model has continuous symmetry, this has very important consequences as far as physics is concerned. Okay. So let me again start by writing down the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory that corresponds to this model, right? I could go through the same calculation as we did for the Ising model, namely, you know, do a Hubbard-Sartorovich transformation for this model, and then take continuum limit. But you know, we are smart now, so we can just write it down based on symmetries, right? So the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory in this case will have the following form. So S of phi, where phi is now a vector, I have integral dx, right? So the gradient term that's allowed, that has this symmetry, is going to have the following form. So it's going to be 1/2 grad phi a, where phi a is the a-th component of this vector, right? Grad phi a dot grad phi a, and there is a summation over the repeated indices here, okay? Plus r over 2, so instead of phi squared, I have now phi dot phi, right? Scalar product, and then plus u over 4, let me have a 4 here again instead of 4 factorial, phi dot phi squared. So basically, you know, this the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory can only depend on scalar products, right? Because it has to be symmetric with respect to rotations. Okay. Now, so in principle, you know, we can take this model and do all the same stuff that we did for the Ising model, right? We can set up 4 minus epsilon expansion. And so this is, in fact, one of your homework problems, right? We can set up 4 minus epsilon expansion. And really, so near 4 dimensions, the physics field would be pretty much the same as for the Ising model. Of course, the critical exponents would be different. They would depend on the number of components of those spins and so on. But other than that, there would be no substantial difference. However, the difference, there is a substantial difference, and that's revealed as we lower the dimension, okay? So it turns out that, so near d equals 4, everything is similar to Ising model. With some, you know, minor quantitative differences, but so as we go in particular near 2 dimensions, so near, as we will see, d equals 2, physics becomes very different. So as far as the Ising model is concerned, nothing special happens in 2 dimensions. You can lower dimensionality and everything is qualitatively the same. However, for such models with continuous symmetry, So things become very interesting and complicated near g equals 2. Okay, yeah.
How many components does the field have?
Well, yeah, so let's say that it has just some general number of components, n. Okay, so phi is equal to phi 1, phi 2, so on, phi sub n. So then the symmetry is O of m. There will be an important dependence, in fact, on the number of components here as well. Okay.
And the dimension where the physics starts changing, that's dependent on the like the dimension of the lattice and not on the number of field components.
This dimension is just the dimension of the lattice, but you are right that there will be a dependence of physics on the number of components. Okay. But so we'll come to this later. Yeah.
For the Heisenberg model, they're the same, right? The dimension and the number of components.
Sorry?
For the Heisenberg model, is the two the same, the dimension of the lattice and the number of field components?
Well, I mean, I can consider a Heisenberg model in any number of dimensions, right?
Yeah.
So n is 3.
N is always 3 for Heisenberg? So
I can call this sort of generalized Heisenberg model, right? For if you think of those as really physical spins, they would typically have 3 components,
okay.
Right? But I can generalize this to any number of components, right? I can have less than 3 components. I can have 2 components if I have what's called an easy plane anisotropy. So that anisotropy term there is called easy axis. So it picks out a particular axis along which the spins want to point, right? If I change the sign of that term, if k was positive, then this would pick out an easy plane, right? The spins would want to lie in the xy plane. They wouldn't want to point in the z direction. So in that case, I would have 2 components.
Near d equals 4, it is similar to the Ising model, so that this Heisenberg model also has this inversion symmetry. If I change all the spin by sign.
Well, of course. I mean, okay. That transformation is contained into all 3, right? I mean, I can just rotate by pi.
Okay.
Okay. So let me first. Rewrite this in a slightly nicer form. So I just want to first sort of talk about the general properties of this thing. So let me separate this vector field phi into its magnitude and direction, right? So this has two separate kind of degrees of freedom that are contained in it, right? The magnitude of this vector and its direction. So let me explicitly separate them, because as we'll see, you know, they will in fact behave very differently, especially near two dimensions. So I can write phi of x as rho of x. So this is going to be the magnitude of phi, and rho is positive always, or non-negative, times n of x. And n of x is going to be unit vector, which is the direction of phi, right? So rho of x is equal to root phi dot phi, right? That's a magnitude. And n of x is a unit vector. So n dot n is equal to 1. Okay? And so let me rewrite this Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory explicitly in terms of rho and n. Right? So the scalar product terms are easy. They obviously depend only on rho, right? This is just rho squared, and this is rho to the fourth, right? So the slightly more complicated thing is this gradient term. So let me deal with that. So let me calculate now the gradient of a's component of phi, gradient of phi a, right? So this is equal to clearly gradient of rho times a's component of n, the vector n, right, plus rho gradient of the a's component of n. So now let me plug this into that term. So I have grad phi a dot grad phi a. So this is equal to grad rho times na plus rho grad na, right, times the same thing. Let me actually write it here. So grad phi a dot grad phi a. So this is grad rho times an a plus rho grad an a times the same thing. Rho and a plus rho grad and a. Okay, so I'll have gradient of rho squared and then an a times an a, which is 1, right? Plus rho squared grad an a dot grad an a. And then across terms, so plus twice grad rho and grad rho times rho and then na grad na, right? And so this is 0, right? Because so n sub a is a unit vector. Its gradient of a vector of fixed length is always transverse to that vector, right? Because it cannot change in the in its you know in its direction because it's fixed, right? So this is always 0. Okay. So what I have is just grad rho squared plus rho squared grad and a. So grad and a, right? Okay, and so then my Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson functional is going to have the following form. So now it depends on rho and n. And I have so integral d dx 1 half grad rho squared plus 1 half rho squared grad an a grad an a. And as I said, those terms just depend on rho, so I have r over 2 rho squared plus u over 4 rho to the fourth, okay? Okay, so let's now do the simplest thing. Let's analyze the corresponding mean field theory. And okay, let's analyze this functional in mean field approximation. So in this case, I can obviously assume that both rho and n are uniform, right? So in mean field theory, both rho and n are uniform, right? So the dependence on n just drops out completely in this case, because I only have the gradient term for n. So this goes away. This also goes away. And so then all I have to do is minimize this this part of the functional, which has exactly the same form as in the mean field theory for the Ising model, right? So what I have to minimize, so I can call this free energy density, small f of rho, is r over 2 rho squared plus u over 4 rho to the fourth. And so if I minimize this, I get exactly the same mean field solution. Well, which is not surprising because, as we discussed, you know, mean field theory basically does not care about anything. It doesn't care about the number of components. The solution is always the same. So I have rho is equal to square root of minus r divided by u when r is less than 0, and rho is equal to 0 when r is greater than 0, right? But so now there is an important difference here, which can be seen even from this simple thing. So let me erase this. So in the case of the Ising model, right, I could draw this free energy as a function of the order parameter f of phi, right? So in this case, the order parameter was a scalar. And so then when r was less than 0, you remember that this function had the following form, these two minima. Which corresponded to two possible signs of the order parameter, right? Say minus phi 0 and phi 0, where phi 0 would be given by precisely by this equation, square root of minus r over u, right? So now what happens here? So suppose, just for you know, purposes of presentation, I have a two-component vector, okay? Because I just cannot draw more than two components. So let phi equal to phi 1, phi 2, right? So in this case, if I draw an analog of this function here, I'm going to have the following thing. So this is f of phi now, and now these are the two components, phi 1 and phi 2. Okay, so this function, if I just take the magnitude of the order parameter, right, it's going to have exactly the same form as this one. But now, if I want to plot this as a function of phi 1 and phi 2, I have to rotate this thing around this axis, right? So the function is going to have the following form. If I can draw it, so it's the same thing. But now it's actually rotated, right? So So this is sometimes called a Mexican hat potential. It's similar to a Mexican hat, I guess. But so the important difference here is that here, so there are those two equivalent signs of the order parameter, right? But to get from here to here, right, I have to go over this energy barrier, right? While here, right, so the order parameter is going to spontaneously choose a direction in the phi 1, phi 2 plane, right? Just as here, it will just spontaneously choose the sign of the order parameter. But now, you know, it can go between the different directions without any energy cost, right? Because rotating phi means just moving along this this valley here in the Mexican head potential, and all the points in the minimum here correspond to the same energy, right? So there is no energy barrier between different directions of the order parameter. Okay, and so this has very, very important consequences. Okay, so the fact that the behavior of such models with continuous symmetry near d equals 2 is very different from the Ising model is a consequence precisely of this fact that you can rotate between different directions of the order parameter without any energy cost. Yeah.
In this case, we have the spontaneous symmetry breaking because of this.
Right, yeah.
So in this case, we don't have
to. No, it's still, so the direction here is arbitrary, right?
Yeah.
So the magnitude of the order parameter is determined by this equation, but the direction is not. Direction is still arbitrary, and that's spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the direction will be chosen spontaneously, right? The direction of the vector n will be chosen spontaneously, so this is still spontaneous symmetry breaking. But the difference is that here there is an energy barrier, you know, for going between this direction and this direction, while here there is no barrier. Okay, I can rotate this vector n without any energy cost. Yeah.
So one of the justifications that we used for defining the order parameter at all was to say that in the infinite lattice size case, you could never go from one side of the symmetry break to the other.
No, that was not justification for defining order parameter. That was just a I mean, that's how I explained why I can just say that you know, the system picks one of the values of the order parameter and does not fluctuate between the two.
Okay.
Right.
So
the same is going to happen here. So it's going to pick if it orders, it's going to pick a particular direction for n, and it's going to stay with this direction forever if the size of the system is infinite.
So, but on this, in this one where you have the continuous set, can't you always find some infinitesimally small energy cost for changing the order parameter?
Sure, the energy cost is infinitesimally small, but the problem is that you have to rotate infinite number of spins simultaneously, which is something that's infinitely unprobable.
Okay, but you don't have regions that are of different spins?
You mean like, no, okay. No. But there is a consequence of this thing, of this symmetry, continuous symmetry, but well, we'll basically come to it. Okay? This makes fluctuations of the order parameter much much easier, basically, and that's why there is this different physics appearing near two dimensions, which does not exist in the case of the Ising model. Ising model is fine basically all the way down to one dimension. fine in the sense that the physics is the same. It's still a transition at finite temperature. Okay. Okay. So now, let's now actually see what are the consequences of this symmetry. So to see that, let me consider now fluctuations around this mean field solution, right? So the mean field solution is rho is equal to this, and then the direction of n is arbitrary, right? So let's now consider small fluctuations about this solution. So let me just assume that, you know, direction of n is arbitrary. So let me pick this direction to be 1, 0, 0, 0, right? So n is going to be along the one, the axis 1, right? I can always rotate my coordinate system, so that's true, okay? For an arbitrary direction of n, I can always rotate my coordinates, so that axis 1 is along n. And so let me write then the field phi of x in the following way. I'll write it as rho times n, okay, plus rho times delta phi, right? So this is the mean field order parameter, right? It's along the n direction and the magnitude is rho, and then this will represent fluctuations, and I just factor out rho here for convenience. Okay, I could have written this just plus delta phi, but I want to factor out the mean field rho because it's going to be convenient. Okay. And told that delta phi, now, I want to distinguish two components of delta phi, right? They will be fluctuations of the field phi along the ordering direction, right? I'll write this as delta phi 1 times n, right? So these are just fluctuations of the magnitude of the order parameter along the ordering direction. Plus, there will be fluctuations in all the transverse directions, all the n minus 1 transverse directions. So I will write this as delta phi perp, right? Delta phi perp is transverse to n, okay? So m dot delta phi perp is equal to 0, right? Or in other words, delta phi perp has no components along n, right? So it's 0, and then delta phi 2, and so on, delta phi m, right? OK, so now let me take this. Take this representation of the order parameter in terms of mean field and fluctuation and plug this into the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory and leave only terms of leading order in fluctuations, right? So the usual thing. So let me deal with different terms separately. So let me first look at the phi dot phi term. And so I have rho m plus rho delta phi times the same thing, rho m plus rho delta phi. So this is going to be rho squared, right? Plus So plus 2 rho squared n dot delta phi. And n dot delta phi is just delta phi 1, right? So this is simply delta phi 1. And then plus rho squared delta phi dot delta phi. And here, let me separate again delta phi 1 and delta phi perp. So I can write the whole thing in the following way. I can factor out rho squared. And then I have 1 plus 2 delta phi 1 plus delta phi 1 squared plus delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, right? So now if I take the phi dot phi to the fourth term, all I have to do is square this, right? And when I square this, I will only leave terms of up to second order in delta phi 1 and delta phi perp, right? So the result is going to be approximately equal to r to the fourth, right? And then, so let me just write down the answer here. So it's going to be 1 plus 6 delta phi 1 squared, right? Plus 2 delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, and then plus 4 delta phi 1. Okay. So this is, again, this is phi dot phi squared. Sorry, this is squared, of course. This is phi dot phi squared, where I left only terms of linear order plus quadratic order and fluctuations. Okay, I've neglected the cubic and quartic terms. And then, okay, so let me erase this thing. Then, so grad phi A dot grad phi A term, finally. So here everything is simple. Since this part and this part of the vector delta phi are orthogonal, right? What I'm gonna get is just separate independent pieces corresponding to grad delta phi 1 dot grad delta phi 1 plus grad delta phi perp dot grad delta phi perp. So this is going to be just equal to rho squared grad delta phi 1 dot grad delta phi 1 plus rho squared grad delta phi perp eighth component grad delta phi perp eighth component. Okay. So let me now collect all the pieces here together. So then my Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson functional of fluctuations in our mean field is going to have the following form. So I have integral dx. So first the gradient pieces, so rho squared over 2 grad delta phi 1 dot grad delta phi 1 plus rho squared over 2 grad delta phi perp eighth component dot grad delta phi perp eighth component, right?
Why are there no grad phi squared terms? the top line.
Sorry, what do you mean? This is grad phi. Grad phi dot grad phi.
Oh, sorry, I meant grad rho.
No. So rho is just the mean field magnitude of the order parameter. That's constant. So the fluctuations of rho are in here. This is fluctuation of the order parameter in the direction of the mean field, in the mean field direction. Okay? So again, basically the meaning of delta phi 1 and delta phi perp is that delta phi 1 is the fluctuation of the magnitude of the order parameter, while delta phi perp is the fluctuation of direction. So then I have phi dot phi, so plus rho r over 2, sorry, again rho squared that I factored out, and then 1 plus 2 delta phi 1 plus delta phi 1 squared plus delta phi perp dot delta phi perp. And then finally the quartic term. So I have plus u divided by 4 rho to the fourth. And then this thing. So 1 plus 4 delta phi 1 plus 6 delta phi 1 squared plus 2 delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, right? Okay, so the piece that doesn't depend on deltas, that's the mean field, Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson functional, right? R over 2 rho squared plus u over 4 rho to the fourth, right? And so that satisfies, that rho satisfies the following equation, that, so rho squared is equal to minus r divided by u, right? Okay, now let me collect all the terms of, let me look at all the terms of first order, right? So this one and this one. So I have r over 2 rho squared times 2 delta phi 1 plus u over 4 rho to the fourth times 4 delta phi 1. So this is equal to r rho squared, right, plus u rho to the fourth times delta phi 1, and this is equal to 0, right, because rho satisfies this equation. This is equal to 0, as it should, because we are expanding, again, around the minimum of Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson functional, and therefore linear terms, if you are expanding around the minimum, they have to vanish. First derivative is 0. Okay, so now let me look at the coefficient of quadratic terms. So let me find the coefficient of delta phi 1 squared, okay? Okay, so the coefficient of delta phi 1 squared is going to be r over 2 rho squared, right, plus, so 6 divided by 4, right, that's 3 halves, plus 3 halves u rho to the fourth, right? This is the coefficient of delta phi 1 squared. Now, let me simplify this again using the equation that rho satisfies. Okay? So if I plug in rho squared is equal to minus r over u, I get minus r squared divided by 2u plus 3/2 u times r squared divided by u squared, right? And so I have minus r squared over 2u plus 3/2 r squared divided by 2u. So this is just plus r squared divided by u, right? So this coefficient of delta phi 1 squared is non-zero and it's positive. Okay. And this I can in fact write in an even better way as rho squared times the absolute value of r. It's the same thing. And then finally, let's find the coefficient of delta phi perp dot delta phi perp. Right? So I have r over 2 times rho squared, and then plus u over 2 rho to the fourth, and you see that this is zero again. Right? So this is zero. So this is very important, and this is in fact the expression of that continuous symmetry, right? So the Landau Ginzburg Wilson theory, functional does not depend on delta phi perp dot delta phi perp, okay? Which means that if I just uniformly rotate all the spins, right, away from the mean field ordering direction, that doesn't cost any energy. The only thing that costs energy is if I rotate the spins non-uniformly. Okay? So there is a gradient term, but there is no uniform term corresponding to the transverse fluctuations. However, there is a energy cost for changing the magnitude of the order parameter. Because when I change the magnitude, I'm going uphill in that Mexican head potential, right? I'm trying to change the direction, I'm just rotating the spin around that valley, right? While if I try to change magnitude, I'm going uphill in this potential, right? That's why there is a finite energy cost here, but the energy cost here is zero. Okay, so then the result we get is the following, that S phi, let me write this as S of delta phi, the Landau-Ginzburg functional fluctuations, is going to have the following form. I have integral dx rho squared over 2. I can just factor it out. And then I have grad delta phi 1 dot grad delta phi 1 plus grad delta phi perp eighth component dot grad delta phi perp eighth component plus 2 absolute value of r delta phi 1 squared. Okay, so very, very simple form, right? So again, the meaning of this is that if I am trying to change the magnitude of the order parameter, there is a finite energy cost associated with that that's given by this term, while uniform rotation of the order parameter away from the ordering direction has no energy cost. Okay. So let me also rewrite this in Fourier space now. Okay. Let me erase this thing. Okay, so I can define Fourier transform of delta phi 1 and delta phi perp in the usual way as 1 over v sum over k delta phi 1 of k e to I k dot x, and same for delta phi perp of x is 1 over v sum over k delta phi perp of k e to I k dot x. And so then when I Fourier transform, as usual, again, I get from those two gradients, I get just k dot k, right? So I get k squared here and k squared here. And then, so the result is s of delta phi is equal to rho squared divided by 2v sum over k. I get k squared times modulus of delta phi 1 of k squared plus k squared delta phi perp eighth component of k times delta phi perp eighth component of minus k, and then plus 2 absolute value of r delta phi 1 of k modulus squared. So, you know, in the language of Fourier components, then, you know, the you can see that the energy cost of fluctuations in the direction of the order parameter remains finite, even if I take k to 0, right? So even uniform fluctuations in the direction of the order parameter cost energy. However, the energy cost of transverse fluctuations, which correspond to fluctuations of the direction of the order parameter, this energy cost is proportional to k squared. So that vanishes in the limit when I take the wave vector of the fluctuations to 0 or wavelength of the fluctuations to infinity, right? And infinite wavelength just corresponds to uniform rotation of all the spins together. Okay? So these modes, delta phi perp, whose energy cost vanishes as k is going to 0, they're called Goldstone modes. So delta phi perp are Goldstone modes. And so this is a very general feature of systems with where continuous symmetry is spontaneously broken. So whenever a continuous symmetry is spontaneously broken, there are Goldstone modes. So there are fluctuations whose energy cost vanishes in the limit k is going to 0. Yeah?
And so I understand that when I have more than one component from my phi, I end up getting this this no cost for energy for changes.
Right.
But what did this have to do with the dimensionality of space?
Well, that's coming. So the fact that the energy cost of the Goldstone modes is so low in the limit when k is going to 0 is going to have significant effect on the physics. So it's the Goldstone modes that are responsible for. We will see it in just a few minutes. Okay? So, you know, in the context of quantum field theory, in the context of particle physics, you know, this is how massless particles arise. Okay? They arise as a consequence of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So whenever you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, there are massless particles, and whose energy is going to zero as the momentum is going to zero. Okay. Okay, so now let me do the following thing. Let's calculate now a correlation function of these fluctuations. Let's calculate correlation function of fluctuations in the of the magnitude of the order parameter and correlation function of the transverse fluctuations. Lower. So let's first calculate G1. So it's going to be the correlation function of delta phi once. Say G1 of x minus x prime. So this is average of delta phi 1 of x delta phi 1 of x prime. I don't need to subtract anything because delta phi is the fluctuation. So its average is 0. Right, by definition, basically. So if I Fourier transform this, I'll have 1 over V sum over K delta phi 1 of K delta phi 1 of minus K E to I K dot x minus x prime, right? And then, so in calculating this average, we just use the you know, the Gaussian integrals that we've discussed before. So remember that this average is just given by basically the inverse of the coefficient of delta phi 1 modulus squared in the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson theory, right?
What would you say here? So you're not taking into account the average of delta phi 1, right? I mean,
because it's zero. It's zero.
Zero.
It's just zero. It's this fluctuation.
Okay, so you.
So average of phi, right? That's just rho times n.
Okay, we're keeping it. Okay.
Yeah. So we are expanding in fluctuations that are midfield. So the average value of phi of x is just equal to rho times n. So which means that the average of delta phi 1 is 0, and delta phi 0 is 1. Okay, so this average, I'm just calculating the Gaussian integral to get it. Minus k, and so this is just equal to v divided by rho squared, right? And then, so k squared plus 2 modulus of r, right? Again, it's just the, inverse, of course, of that. So 1 divided by k squared plus 2 magnitude of r, right? So this is just the coefficient of delta phi 1 here, k squared plus 2 r. And so then, so k squared has dimensions of inverse length squared. So therefore, this has dimensions of inverse length squared. Can call this psi, the correlation length. So this is equal to 2r, right? And then basically, you know, the Fourier transform of this has exactly the same form as as a Fourier transform for mean field correlation function in the Ising model. So I'll just write down the answer. So this is going to be proportional to 1 divided by x minus x prime to the power d minus 2, right? That's exactly the same power as we had for the correlation function of the Ising model. And you know, this just follows from dimensional analysis. If you count all the dimensions of k that go into calculating this integral, so you must have this. And then since there is this length scale here for k, this gives me an exponential of, you know, e to minus x prime divided by this psi. So e to minus x prime divided by psi, okay? Up to coefficients which are not important.
Calculate the correlation function just for one type of mode, right? Not for the Goldstone mode.
Yeah, so this is for the delta phi
right.
1 mode.
So you're defining the correlation function for those modes.
Yeah. Yeah, so correlation function of
length.
Fluctuations of length of the order parameter.
Okay, so the correlation length in here for the whole system would be just this correlation length, or there might be a correlation
no.
length?
No, so as we will see in a second, you know, in fact, those modes and the Goldstone modes behave differently. So they have different correlation functions, okay? So this is correlation lengths just for the longitudinal modes, for the modes corresponding to fluctuations of the magnitude of the order parameter. So you have to distinguish the two. Okay, so the point here is that delta phi ones have the fluctuations of the magnitude of the order parameter have a finite correlation length, right? And this correlation length diverges as we approach the transition, right? So psi squared is equal to 1 divided by 2 modulus of r. And since r is going to 0 at the critical temperature, right, this correlation length is diverging at the transition. So since r is going to 0 at t equals tc, remember that we are just doing mean field theory plus fluctuations. So psi is going to infinity as t is going to tc. And it's going to infinity in exactly the same way as for the Ising model. As in mean field theory of the Ising model, is just 1 over t minus tc, right? So, it's just going as 1 over t minus tc to the 1/2, right? So the correlation length critical exponent is 1/2, as is always the case in mean field theory. However, now let's calculate the same correlation function, but for the Goldstone modes. Right, so I have G perp, let's say, right, of x minus x prime. So this is going to be delta phi perp A of x delta phi perp A of x prime, right? And again, there is a summation here over all the components. So this is equal to 1 over V sum over K delta phi perp A of K perp A of minus K E to I K dot X minus X prime. And now this average, so this again, this is an inverse coefficient of delta phi perp in the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson function, and that's just proportional to 1 over k squared, right? So this is equal to then 1 over V, sum over K. I screwed up a little bit. This should be 1 over V squared because there is a factor of V coming from each of the delta phis, and then 1 power of V is canceled by this V. Okay? And then I have 1 over V sum over K, which can be transformed into an integral over K. So this is 1 over V then, and then integral of 1 over rho squared K squared E to I K dot X minus X prime. So here, you see that the correlation length of the Goldstone modes is always infinite, right? So this factor of 1 over psi squared is just 0 in this case. Okay, so then this correlation function is just proportional to 1 over x minus x prime to d minus 2 without the exponential factor, okay? So correlation length of Goldstone modes is always infinite. Everywhere below the critical temperature, the correlation length of Goldstone modes is infinite, okay? And that has to do, again, it's a direct consequence of the fact that the energy cost of Goldstone modes goes to 0 as the wave vector is going to 0. Okay?
So it appears from here that when you have d equals 2, correlation function is just 1.
Well, d equals 2 is kind of special. Okay? So we'll have to discuss d equals 2 separately.
Where did you get the correlation length infinite thing? Sorry, I don't see where that came
from. Well, so correlation length comes from here, right? So there is k squared plus something.
Yeah, and there's no something. So
that something, yeah, that something is absent there.
Okay.
So this something has dimensions of 1 over length squared, right? Because the wave vector has dimensions of inverse length. And, well, so its meaning is the correlation length. This is something that sets that defines the length scale. System. So there is no such thing over there. So the correlation function has a scale invariant form. It's just a power law. Yeah.
So it looks like for dimensions less than 2, the correlation actually increases?
Well, no. So for dimensions, okay, so again, that's coming. So for dimensions less than 2, Let's just wait a few minutes, and we'll see what the significance of d equals 2 is. And it's indeed very significant. So it's just one step. So let me now calculate a mean square fluctuation of delta phi perp. Right? So let me raise. Oops, no, let me raise this. So let me calculate, there is one other thing that I've missed there. So since I have a sum over A over there, right, this whole thing is proportional to the number of Goldstone modes, which is n minus 1. So just multiply this by n minus 1. Okay. So now I have delta phi perp A of x times delta phi perp A of x, right? So this is just going to be that correlation function, g perp taken at 0, right? So I'm just calculating mean square fluctuation of the direction of the order parameter at one point, right? So then this is equal to n minus 1 divided by rho squared 1 over v sum over k 1 over k squared, right? And so in this case, let me just do this integral explicitly, right? This is very simple. So if I transform 1 over v sum over k to an integral, right, I get n minus 1 rho squared integral d dk 2 pi to the d 1 divided by k squared, right? So I can rewrite this integral in the following way using spherical coordinates. I have n minus 1 rho squared, my surface area of unit sphere in d dimensions, S sub d, 2 pi to the d, and then integral from 0 to some cutoff lambda, which is again is proportional to inverse lattice spacing. So I have dk, k to d minus 1, right, divided by k squared. So this is n minus 1 rho squared s d 2 pi to the d integral from 0 to lambda dk, and then k to d minus 3. Okay, and now, so clearly, if d is greater than 2, right, this integral is convergent, right? So which means that I get some finite mean square fluctuation. So the magnitude, which means that the magnitude of the order parameter is going to be less than the mean field one, but it's still finite. It's still non-zero. Okay. So integral converges. Right? And so which basically means that so the real TC is going to be less due to fluctuations, as we've seen in for the case of the Ising model, right? The real TC is less than the mean field TC, but there is still a finite non-zero TC. Okay, so TC is less than TC mean field, but TC is still non-zero. Right? So there is a transition between disordered and an ordered phase at some temperature, some non-zero temperature. However, when D is less or equal to 2, right, then this integral diverges at the lower limit. Right? Diverges at k going to 0. Right? What does this mean that this integral diverges? So what this is saying is that the mean square fluctuation of the order parameter is divergent, right? Well, what this really means is that our assumption that we can expand around mean field theory is just wrong, okay? And so what this means is that when d is less or equal to 2, there is simply no transition. There is simply no ordered phase at any finite temperature. So in this case, it means that TC, the real TC, is equal to 0, okay? So there is simply no phase transition in this case. Okay. So this is an important result. It's called Mermin-Wagner theorem. Particle physicists sometimes add Coleman here, because he apparently derived an equivalent result. But so this theorem says that basically that in systems with continuous symmetry, there is no long-range order at any finite temperature for dimension less or equal to 2. Yeah.
Expansion around mean field theory breaks down. So
right.
How can we conclude that there's no?
Well, yeah. So strictly speaking, we cannot really conclude that. So what Berman and Wagner did, they've actually proved this result exactly. This is just kind of a hint that something like this is happening. But yeah.
Could you skip the theorem again?
The theorem says that in systems with continuous symmetry, there is no long-range order at any finite temperature in dimensions less or equal to 2. And so this dimension 2, then, so it obviously has a special significance for systems with continuous symmetry. This is called lower critical dimension. So G equals 2 is the lower critical dimension. And so basically, its significance is that TC, as a function of dimensionality, right, is going to 0 when D is equal to 2. Right? It's going to 0 when D approaches 2 from above. Okay? So we have upper critical dimension 4, right? And the meaning of that is that above four dimensions, mean field theory works. We don't have to worry about fluctuations, while below four dimensions, we do have to worry about fluctuations, right? Fluctuations change the properties of the transition significantly. And then, so as we continue keep decreasing dimensions, if we have a system with continuous symmetry, the transition, in fact, disappears in two dimensions entirely. While for Ising model, nothing special happens in two dimensions. So for the Ising model, the transition disappears in one dimension only.
It's a classical result, right? I mean, it's for a classical Heisenberg or Ising model. Or...
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so in quantum case, I guess you consider time as the extra dimension. So in that case,
yeah, but I mean, I can have long-range order at zero temperature if I consider a Hamiltonian in a quantum version, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you can have long-range order in a 1D system at zero temperature, yeah. Okay. Okay, and so as it turns out, so we can use this fact that the critical temperature vanishes as dimensionality approaches 2 to set up a different epsilon expansion now, right? So I'm not going to do that, don't worry. I'll just quote the results. So basically, in the 4 minus epsilon expansion, we use the deviation from upper critical dimension as small parameter. Okay? And in that case, so the actual small parameter in the lambda of Ginzburg theory is u, right? Because the fixed point value of u is proportional to epsilon. So here, we can use Tc itself as a small parameter. Okay. So let me just... Again, I'm not going to develop this in all details because, you know, this is far less pretty than 4 minus epsilon expansion. So I'm not going to torture you with this. So let's just talk about kind of generally what kind of results we can get. So let me first take into account this information that we've got from here, that basically the important a piece of the physics in systems with continuous symmetry, at least near lower critical dimension, is always Goldstone modes, right? Because it's the Goldstone modes that lead to this divergent fluctuation of the order parameter, right? So basically what we want to do is, if we are near two dimensions, we want to retain in our Landau-Ginzburg theory only the piece that corresponds to the Goldstone modes. We don't care about fluctuations of the magnitude of the order parameter. So I have my Landau-Ginzburg function, which depends on rho and n, right? Dx. So I have 1/2 rho squared grad n a dot grad n a plus 1/2 grad rho squared plus r over 2 rho squared plus u over 4 rho to the fourth, right? And so the point is that if dimensionality is close to 2, if d is near the lower critical dimension, it's the fluctuations of m which are important. It's the fluctuations of the direction of the order parameter which precisely correspond to those Goldstone modes. But then we can just ignore the fluctuations of rho, the fluctuations of the magnitude, and just set rho to some fixed value, right, which roughly corresponds to its mean field value. And then my S simplifies, so I have S, which depends only on M, and it's just equal to rho squared over 2 integral d dx grad na dot grad na, right, where na is a unit vector. So it's restricted to have magnitude 1, okay? So this is called nonlinear sigma model. So you know why it's sigma model is irrelevant. This just comes from the name comes from particle physics from a really long time ago. The nonlinear part just corresponds to the fact that I have to always explicitly keep in mind this constraint that the vector n is a unit vector. Okay? If there was no such constraint, right, this would have been a very simple theory. This is just a Gaussian theory, right? It's just quadratic in n, right? And then it would be exactly solvable. But what makes it difficult and not exactly solvable is the fact that n is a unit vector. Okay? And so this nonlinear sigma model is what describes basically the physics of systems with continuous symmetry near lower critical dimension. Okay, so we had phi to the fourth theory, which was relevant basically near four dimensions, right? And so near two dimensions, it's this nonlinear sigma model that's important. Okay, that describes the physics. So you see here that so the only coupling constant that describes this system now is this rho squared, right? So in the case of pi to the fourth model, we had two coupling constants, rho and u, r and u, right? Here it's just one, so that's a nice feature, right? So it's usually rewritten in the following way, right? So since this is a Landau-Ginzburg functional, which means that the partition function of the system can be written as a functional integral, so dm e to minus s of m. So it's clear that this rho squared, right, must be proportional to inverse temperature, right? Because the inverse temperature always enters into the statistical mechanical weight, right? So rho squared must be proportional to 1 over t, right? And it's so we can just redefine our temperature units, so that this coefficient is exactly equal to 1 over t. Okay, so then S of n is usually written just in the following way, as S of n equals 1 over 2t integral d dx grad n a dot grad n a. And so then, as I mentioned, we can set up 2 plus epsilon expansion using the fact that t, the fixed point value of t, is going to approach 0 as dimensionality approaches 2. Okay, so basically the t star is going to go to 0 as d is going to 2. And so this fact can be used to set up 2 plus epsilon expansion, okay? Which I'm not going to do, as I said, you know, in spite of the fact that this looks may look simpler than phi to the fourth theory, 2 plus epsilon expansion is actually uglier, a lot uglier than 4 minus epsilon expansion, okay? So let me just let's talk about the results tomorrow. Okay, I won't have time to finish them today anyway. Okay.